Welcome to the Catskill Review of Books, a weekly program interviewing authors, hosted by Ian Williams and produced by Kevin Greff in the hydro-powered studios of WJFF in Jeffersonville, New York.
So, this is Ian Williams with yet another edition of the Catskill Review of Books. And today, we're talking to Tracy Kwan, whose books include Diary of a Married Call Girl, Diary of a Manhattan Call Girl, and Diary of a Jet-Setting Call Girl. You will notice there's a theme here. And Tracy is also an activist in things like Pony, the Prostitutes of New York, and was only recently on television attacking one of the Mrs. Grundys from the Christian right who wants to make prostitution illegal as a matter of human rights for the prostitutes. I couldn't compute it, and neither could Tracy. So, Tracy, who are your readers?
Well, I feel that my readers really come from every walk of life. I have been told at times that my readers are predominantly female. I have a lot of male readers, though. Mm-hmm. I feel that this is chick lit that a guy can relate to.
Well, I noticed one of the reviewers put it in a genre of trick lit, which is...
Yes. That is a term that was invented by a book reviewer at Time Out New York.
Yeah? Oh, well, it's a fun one. I always appreciate playfulness with language.
Tricklet, referring not to the gay American concept of a trick, which is just a casual sex partner, but to a punter. It's an American term, punter. It's a little bit disrespectful. It's not as nice a word as John or client, but it's also playful.
Mm-hmm. And the reaction, as we saw from, I forget her name because she was so eminently forgettable. It was very fun to ask you, you're asking this sort of frumpy, middle-aged Christian housefrau what her experience in sex work was.
Janice Krauss, who is a senior fellow at the Beverly LaHaye Institute, which is part of the Concerned Women for America outfit.
And she's the wife of Timothy LaHaye, who wrote the Left Behind series that proves that all of us ungodly people will be left behind to be melted and tortured by the devil when the good guys go.
Something like that. Yeah, Beverly LaHaye, the founder of that. Yeah. And this was one of her proteges.
Uh-huh. But I mean, she was throwing out in that all sorts of statistics. 90% of girls in the industry want to get out. And I noticed that the anchor person never asked her for the substance of these, because she said it's something that everybody knows, presumably like that the Bible is infallible, that evolution is a figment of atheist imagination, and all of the other things that everybody knows, according to her.
When, of course, we realize that evolution is actually a theory. I think that the host was sort of counting on me to take care of that. I think that there's been a tense relationship between the sex workers and the media, sex workers' rights advocates and the media and the MSM for quite a while. But I think a lot of things have changed, and that they sort of a kind of enlightenment has occurred over the past 10 years. And I think they kind of expect us to step up to the plate and defend ourselves.
Which a lot more of you and your colleagues are prepared to do than ever before in public.
Millions. In India, currently, right now, we have a really interesting situation in Bangalore. The sex workers union says that they have about 20,000 sex workers in Bangalore, most of whom are registered voters, and who are in the municipal elections coming up at the end of March are planning on, you know, making their point.
I did have a friend once who stood as the socialist candidate in Bombay, and he said he won on the sex workers' vote near Grant Road, near the station there.
It
was fun to see them all going down to the vote in the saris. I'm not quite sure whether he ever... I rather suspect that he patronized them in more ways than one, but that's another story.
Well, and a lot of people do. But and in Bangalore right now, we have the vice president of that sex workers union. Her name is Veena. She's also transgender, and she's the first transgender candidate, political candidate in Bangalore, and she's running in this election for her ward. Mm-hmm. Oh. So it's very encouraging.
But recently also you interviewed the brothel, what was her name? Sorry, I've forgotten it now. But
Kristen Davis, who spent 4 months in solitary confinement because of her association with Elliot Spitzer. Is that who you mean?
That's who I mean. I mean, I think, you know, Elliot Spitzer deserved to be nailed for hypocrisy because as Attorney General, of course, he'd been prosecuting people for doing and providing the services which he was buying later. So on that, I've got very short shrift for him on that count. But in this particular case, the idea that somebody would go to prison for 4 months for providing a service used by half of the politicians in the area, including such a notable one, that really is a sort of serious human rights issue, not the Christian right one either.
Well, so this is on the front of my website. It was a Daily Beast column that I did, and Kristen is running for governor, which is we quite like that. I mean, she's running for Elliot Spitzer's former job, and she recently had a press conference in front of his home, which I thought was kind of interesting. In fact, there's some – we have some questions. Like Kristen Davis isn't the most politically correct sex industry person. For she supports, for example, the – she wants to see a scenario such as we have in Nevada or in Sweden. We don't actually – the – prevalent view in the sex workers movement, we're not really in favor of the laws in Sweden which punish
the client. We should explain that. I was going to say we should explain this because in Sweden, and now being emulated by the New Labour Mrs. Grundy's in Britain, the idea is that instead of making prostitution illegal, you will actually jail the clients or you will prosecute the clients, which of course is it's shifting the problem, not solving it.
No, and it actually makes it really hard to be a sex worker. And Nevada has a very regulated system, which some people like and some people don't. And so Kristen, when I met Kristen, she expressed a lot of support for those two models. You know, so I don't necessarily agree with her on every single point, but I think it's fantastic that she's out there running for governor. I think it's really important for sex workers to do that kind of thing and to sort of put themselves on the democratic agenda, you know, making democracy meaningful.
Mm-hmm. Now, returning to your literary activities as opposed to the activism, although the two are tied together. I remember when you were first writing your first book that you were you sort of claimed that you were attempting to emulate Jane Foster, and I believe the last one you sort of...
You mean Jane Austen?
Yes.
Yes.
And I think the last one you mentioned Winnie the Pooh, or was it Tintin? And Winnie the Pooh, you've mentioned
you
the
know,
models
I,
in here.
I mentioned Jane Austen because, you know, that's something that people, you know, of course we can all relate to. Also, in terms of Jane Austen, my influences for the first novel, Diary of a Manhattan Call Girl, were, you know, Bridget Jones and indeed Winnie the Pooh. You know, those are archetypes that we all recognize, Piglet and so forth. My most recent novel, Diary of a Jet Setting Call Girl, that's very influenced by my love of Tintin.
And his dog Snowy.
I don't really care that much about Snowy. I have to confess, I'm not a big dog person. But I just these things are not linear. They're very intuitive, and we just kind of get, you know, our imaginations are just sort of grabbed by these sort of figures. And but I like the idea of like imagining a Tintin-esque adventure for my heroine, Nancy Chan, who's a Manhattan call girl and is now married. And her favorite customer asks her to go to the south of France and spend some time in a house that he's recently remodeled.
Anyone who picks them up looking for a well-sum dirty read is going to be disappointing because it is...
No, don't say that, Ian! Is that true?
Well, no, as some of your reviewers have said, there's a lot of good sex in there. But, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of people who read erotica, especially in American, they really think of a smut because they want it to be sort of dirty and soiled, whereas you treat this as a sort of It's you're a working girl, and you're in the novels. Nancy is balancing the career as against friends and colleagues, and against husbands and romantic interest as well. And so, you know, in that sense, the refreshing bit is you're treating this as an entirely normal working, not normal job and profession, and as opposed to within the constraints of the law, of course, as opposed to being something that is in itself erotic and a frisson for the reader.
Right. Well, and also describing the sex in a way that makes sense to someone in the industry. In other words, it's not. It's not your typical soft porn, which is a little bit detached from reality. It is about, like, there is a lot of sex, but it's about what's kind of going through your mind while you're having sex, and really treating it as work, and also without resorting to the sort of cliche of grunge that I see way too much of in sexual writing.
That's what I'm referring to. I mean, this is
this
is clean, healthy, fun stuff. Has complications, but
you know, for me, I wanted to write something that you can read while you're having your lunch, because I like to read while I'm eating, and I find that you cannot do this all the time. Even if you're just reading the New York Times, everything has just become so graphic, and people are trying almost too hard to offend each other. And I thought, you know, it would be refreshing and maybe even a little piquant to be genteel.
Something that perhaps
only a sex worker would would come up with. But in my experience, there is a place, just as there's a place for genteel sex, you know, commercial sex that's a bit genteel, there is for sex writing. And so that's what I've set out to do. I've been told that there are some useful tricks of the trade in my books, too. That was not intended, but that's what I've been told.
And tricks of the trade of use to what, people entering the profession or people wanting to fantasize about the profession?
For anybody, for example, who would wonder how to make sex with a condom, you know, more social and enjoyable and flow more smoothly, things like that. Because that's something that our characters in these novels are very good at. Nancy is constantly agonizing about, you know, how the condom will affect what's about to happen and that sort of thing.
That makes it seem a bit too intrusive, really, if you keep having to worry about it. But one can see why it's essential in these days.
It's not intrusive at all. And in fact, in Diary of a Jet Set and Call Girl, and also in Diary of a Married Call Girl, one of the funnier conversations they have, maybe we should just mention who some of these characters are. Nancy Chan is the central call girl, the protagonist. And she has these two friends, Jasmine and Allison. And her friend Jasmine, they're discussing condoms, and they both find that sex without a condom has become really awkward. They have the opposite experience of a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. I'm not surprised you don't get a WHO health grant for publishing the books as well.
Well, in fact, the WHO is one of the UN wings that has one of the best relationships with the sex workers movement. You know, a lot of our projects and organizations throughout the world are, in fact, working with WHO.
Well, one of the other angles, coming back to Sister Krauss and the evangelicals, is in the jet-setting Call Girl, Mary Magdalene actually surfaces. And I remember you wrote in the Daily Beast about going to visit Mary Magdalene Shinbone in Brooklyn. Perhaps you should enlighten people about the role of Mary Magdalene in the world, not to mention her shinbone.
I did visit her shinbone in her tibia, yes, in Brooklyn, but also on Lexington Avenue. I didn't have to actually go that far. First, she debuted on Lexington Avenue, which is, in my opinion, the way to go. you don't want to start in Brooklyn. And then she went to Pennsylvania and came back to Brooklyn. It was really a fun adventure. Now, this was recently in the fall of 2009. But just a few years before that, I went to the south of France to research my third novel. And I hung out in the area where Mary Magdalene's relics have kind of resided for the past 1,000 years. They're very central to the third novel. And what happens is that Nancy Chan, the Manhattan call girl, ends up in St. Maxima, which is the town that houses some of Mary Magdalene's relics. Without giving away the plot, she ends up having a rather strange, unexpected misadventure involving these relics. And, well, that's all we should say about that for now. But...
Well, let's get back to the relics. I mean,
yes, what would you like to know, Ian? I'm an expert on the relics now.
Well, we should explain, I think, listeners, in case they've forgotten, that Magdalene was actually a sex worker, Mary Magdalene.
Mary Magdalene is a constructed sort of figure. I mean, we don't really know who she was, but we know what she means more than who she was. She was a very important figure in Southern Europe in the medieval period, and women identified with Mary Magdalene in the same way that we today identify with someone like Michelle Obama. I'm not trying to besmirch. I'm not saying anything about Michelle Obama's sex life. I'm just saying that she was a huge figure. Another person we might compare her to is Margaret Thatcher, actually, because she was the only female apostle. In fact, you know what? I think Maggie Thatcher is a better comparison. Sorry to say that, Ian.
Well, yes, you know my feelings on Margaret Thatcher, but I do feel sure that she'd have been on top in any position. So.
Absolutely. But we're not really talking about her politics. We're just talking about her persona, you know, in terms of men and women. And so as the apostle to the apostles, you know, this is right. I mean, for that era, for that medieval period, this is a very powerful female figure. And she was known or thought to have converted southern France to Christianity.
Well, I mean,
I'm feeling the Maggie comparison more and more as I speak to you.
Oh, please, please, get over it. Have a conversion on the road to Damascus.
I'm feeling it.
But one of the points about Mary Magdalene, of course, was that she was a strong and strong feminist character in the middle of a church that was basically misogynist, since St. Paul had decided that women were the root of all evil, the root of original sin, et cetera, to the confusion of everybody for 2,000 years trying to sort of square the theological circle about this.
What
do people pray to the shin bone for? Do they get better orgasms, or is it women's fulfillment? People usually in the church when relic hunting.
People do not pray to the shin bone. That is not at all what you're supposed to do.
No, okay.
Yeah. The tibia is it's kind of, in my opinion, well, first of all, it's very much against the rules to pray to a relic. You're not supposed to do that.
You're not supposed to, but a lot of people do, you know, just like the sort of the Virgin Mary on the cheese on toast, on the cheese toasty, and all of the other great miracles that seem to beset New York lately. You're not supposed to pray to the relics, but many of the faithful do precisely that, don't they?
Well, I don't think that faith is ever precise. There is this pagan animistic thing running through popular Catholicism, and that has kept Catholicism accessible to a lot of ordinary people, and you know, made it more flexible. Because you know, religion, when it gets too inflexible, is usually it's just not that friendly. And so the relics, I think, this is the first time these particular relics have come to the United States, and I think it gives people something tangible
to, something you can see, it's something your imagination can play with and relate to, and I think that recycling these relics and doing a kind of modern medievalism thing is going to keep the Catholic Church alive and give it a little bit of a revival, which it most definitely needs. If you can see how you can see the inroads that are being made by evangelical Protestants in Latin America.
Mm-hmm. Has anyone done a DNA test on the bone like they did with the Shroud of Turin?
Well, I don't think it would work because you'd have to compare it to the DNA of somebody else, and who mm-hmm. would you compare it to? And I don't think that people in the higher, you know, levels of the church expect, I don't think that they take this literally. I think that the relics are understood to be a kind of a way for people to relate to the church. You know, the Catholic Church has obviously been around for quite a long time, and literalism is no longer really the thing, if it ever was.
Mm. Well, explain how Saint Mary Magdalene ties in with sex work and with the plot of Jet Setting Call Girl.
Right. So Mary Magdalene has, in the popular imagination, been seen as a prostitute for a long time, as a harlot, as a preacher, a sinner, many things. But the prostitute bit really kind of got people going. I mean, women were very attracted to that, and so were men. And she was the pinup girl for a long time in paintings and so forth, and sculptures. Now, there is a movement to take that away from Mary Magdalene and restore her sexual virtue. There are a lot in real life, I'm talking about, and in fiction. So in this novel, in Jet Setting Call Girl, Diary of a Jet Setting Call Girl, there are some anti-prostitution feminists who actually want to kind of redefine Mary Magdalene. And that reflects something that's going on in real life. They feel that she was slandered and that she wasn't really a prostitute.
From your point of view, isn't it a little odd to regard this as a slander, since you're upholding the dignity of the worth of the profession?
Right. I mean, this all gets very poetic, right? I mean, nobody in their right mind is really, really should really be debating who Mary Magdalene was, because, you know, she's more of a symbol. But of course, it's very important for Christianity to have somebody like this, and it's quite wrong and unnatural to try to wipe that out after thousands of years. After 1,000 years, let me not exaggerate. 1,500, whatever.
You're making her sound like Mary MacGuffin as opposed to Mary Magdalene. This is a plot.
So in the novel, in Diary of a Jet Setting Call Girl, the sex workers from the New York Council of Trollops and Bad Girls Without Borders get together, and they try to save Mary Magdalene's bad reputation. And, well, I kind of had a lot of fun with that.
Oh, sorry, I did hit the nail on the head then. It is an inverse form of the slander for your characters is the idea to actually sort of make her virtuous.
Yeah, and what I also wanted to show was how sex workers who may appear to be rebellious to some people may in other contexts be cultural preservationists, may even be viewed as conservative. It's actually more radical to try to turn Mary Magdalene into a non-prostitute. I mean, it's much more traditional to view her as a sinner.
So what comes after Mary Magdalene? Are you working on another project at the moment?
Yes, but that's a secret.
That's a secret project. Is it going to be in the great tradition of Nancy, or are you
Nancy Chan? French?
Yes.
It might be, but then again, it might be nonfiction. I'm writing regularly for the Daily Beast, and people can also see the MSNBC video on my blog.
And you do The Guardian online as well.
I sometimes write for The Guardian, yep. And I have a website, tracykwan.net. It's Kwan with a Q, and it's .net, not .com. And that's where my blog is. Uh-huh. I also have a YouTube channel.
Yeah, so no one can accuse you of going undercover here.
No, and I've been tweeting. And I really enjoy it. I actually have decided that Twitter is more fun than Facebook.
You do? Oh, well, I still haven't quite got the hang of it all.
I feel that Facebook is too much like real life.
Ah.
Mm. And if I wanted that, I would just, you know, I don't have to go on Facebook to have a real life. Whereas Twitter is, it's kind of its own reality.
I have been invited to review the first Twitter novel, but I really, you know, I think that the old thing about this, you can learn more from a 3-minute record than you can ever learn in school. I never believed it then, and I'm not quite sure you can get too much literary depth in a Twitter, even though you're having fun.
Send it to me. I'll review it.
Okay, I'll get it off to you. Yes. But one of the things about your books is they have a large international reputation. I've seen Dutch editions, Japanese editions. What else have you had published? I mean, what other editions have there been?
Well, Diary of a Manhattan Call Girl has been published in about 14 languages, including Portuguese. It's soon going to be out in Vietnam. And Diary of a Jet-Setting Call Girl was recently published in France. Which was of course natural and appropriate and lots of fun. And I've actually lost track a bit. There's an Italian edition of Diary of a Married Call Girl.
Uh-huh. And it must be fun having a shelf full of them all. I presume you do.
Yes. I recently had to take all my books to storage, though, because I have too many books.
I know the feeling. It's one of the joys of living up in the Catskills is you've got space for them all. You should consider it sometime.
No. And one of the joys of living in Manhattan is that you can put everything in Manhattan mini storage and just go and visit your things.
Occasionally. I think before we wind up, you mentioned your blogs, you mentioned your YouTube, you've mentioned your future, but do you have any, are there any sort of plans to make films of any of these books? Because they seem to be, they're actually much better plotted than Sex in the City and the other apologies.
That's very sweet of you to say. Diary of a Jet-Setting Call Girl, there are a few people asking me about the possibilities of a romantic comedy because of the plot. But I haven't signed on the dotted line yet, so the rights are available.
Can I audition to play Mary Magdalene Shinbone?
Oh, I see. I knew there was there's a secret agenda here.
I've always wanted to be a Shinbone. But I think that's all we have time for now, Tracy. Thank you very much, and it's been a pleasure, as always, talking to you. And so this is Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Books, and we've been talking to Tracy Kwan, Diary of a Married Call Girl, Diary of a Manhattan Call Girl, and Memoirs of a Jet-Setting Call Girl are all available. Powell's books for the last one, because it hasn't been published in the US yet. It's been published in Britain, where they know about these things. They recognize the Jane Austen and Tintin aspects, presumably. Thanks a lot, Tracy.
Thank you.
Tune in next week at the same time for another edition of the Catskill Review of Books on WJFF.